Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome back to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105 as we begin a new series exploring the creative side of life in Cambridge and talk to the people making it happen with their work in the fields of art, literature, theatre, music, poetry and exhibitions, and in fact anything else that sounds interesting. In this edition, we'll drop into the Fitzwilliam Museum to visit curator of the Edgar Degas Passion for Perfection exhibition, Jay Munro, and discover what goes into creating a fascinating journey through a great artist's life and explore his extraordinary story. Art Language Locations founder Robert Good gives us an update on what's in store for 2018 in Cambridge and looks back on 5 years of achievements in the city. Translator and poet John Drew puts down his pen and talks about the challenge of entertaining Chinese visitors to Cambridge and how the work of Chinese poet Zhu Shimo comforts those in culture shock and never fails to entertain. And Gallery 9's Paul Arsenault gives us a studio walk around to talk about his paintings and inspiration as a fish outside an American pond and where he's taking the venue with its growing links to Cambridge School of Art's newest talent. There's still a chance to encounter one of the great Parisian artists of the 19th and early 20th century at the Fitzwilliam Museum this month, but you'll have to be quick, as the Edgar Degas Passion for Perfection centenary exhibition, which has left people impressed from far and wide, closes on January the 14th. Edgar Degas is often described as a founder of Impressionism, but as I found out, didn't actually call himself an Impressionist and was even dismissive of landscapes, preferring being thought of simply as a realist and independent artist. He's put into context in this centenary exhibition, which encompasses works by many other great artists, making a show that's practically compulsory for the art lover. Curator Jay Munro is keeper of paintings, drawings and prints at the Fitzwilliam Museum and is also director of studies in history of art at Christ College. She specialises in European paintings and drawings of the 19th and early 20th centuries. What was the initial plan for the exhibition and did it turn out the way you were expecting it to?
I think the exciting thing about organising any exhibition is negotiating the hurdles along the way. So you must start out with a plan, you must have a general idea, and especially with loan exhibitions, sometimes you don't get the loan you first asked for, but your attention is taken in a different direction. Actually, it often turns out better than your first idea. But the principal idea of the exhibition was to put the Fitzwilliam's own stellar collection of works by Degas in context. How we've gone about it is to use the core of the Cambridge collections, which is what's at the Fitzwilliam, but also a number of drawings and paintings which come from King's College and bequeathed to them by the economist John Maynard Keynes, who collected them at sales after Degas' death in Paris in 1918 and 1919. Now, those form the basis of a thematic approach. So the exhibition doesn't set out to be a comprehensive life story of Degas, but to give very interesting snapshots of his main preoccupations throughout his career. So, for example, we start by looking at how Degas looked at other artists, how he learned. He was a very disciplined man, and he studied and rehearsed, repeated things to perfect them throughout his career. There's a section on his landscape painting. There's a section, of course, on the dance, which is what he's best known for.
Now, who influenced him the most amongst other artists? Because he was both interested in great masters and in contemporaries as well, wasn't he? Because
absolutely
he
right.
Felt that he had to draw on other people's art quite heavily.
He certainly copied old masters. We've got examples in the exhibition of early Italian painters or Dutch and Flemish painters of the 17th century. In his own century, he looked very much at artists who were the generation before him, like Delacroix and especially Ingres, the master of the drawn line. Towards the end of his career, he formed important collections of paintings and drawings of both of those artists. So I think what's important also to remember about Degas is that he had the humility to refer to these artists throughout his life, not just as a young man, but he drew on them in order to do something different. That was his view.
Degas very much, I mean, obviously half of his paintings were of dancers, and also his nudes of women were always about trying to catch people in an unusual pose or position or from an angle that people normally yes. wouldn't do that. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Degas said about his interest in the dance, for example, that it was just an excuse to paint some pretty dresses, which of course I don't think we not to take that comment absolutely at face value. Degas had a habit of throwing out comments which, as one great Degas scholar said, he didn't really mean. But he also said that he thought that studying the ballet gave him an idea of movement, a sort of an idea of movement that he, movement in sort of ancient Greek sculpture. So it's clear in the ballet that he's interested in movement, but also he does these wonderful scenes of dancers not performing, dancers waiting in the wings, dancers tired and fatigued. And I think that perhaps one of the, he had some empathy with these dancers, because dancing is a highly disciplined activity, as you know. I think that's very obvious in his studies of the nudes, that he tries to show almost the sort of extremities of the human body, how far he can push it into doing very unclassical and very unusual sorts of poses. And there are several examples of that in the exhibition. Of course, he told his friend Sickert that he wanted to study these women as if they were seen through a keyhole, which carries overtones, of course, of a sort of voyeurism. But it also, there are other things that I think it needs to be looked at more generally in terms of his art and what he set out to do. So, for example, he would encourage himself in his own studio, he makes little notes to himself, to study the model by moving round the model, to see it from different angles, by also studying it from below and going up a ladder and studying it from above. And I think when you see a number of the drawings, in particular in the exhibition, you can see that it's almost as if he's stalking his prey in a way.
Now, he was criticised for that, wasn't he, for especially his depictions of working class girls, because people felt that in some way that he was a misogynist, didn't they?
Yes, and I think this is a debate that's still ongoing. I mean, there was certainly a vast array of literature, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, which looked very much at Degas' treatment of the female form and of female figures. And you can't deny that there's an element of it which neutralises the woman in a way. When you look at some of these drawings, you hardly ever see their expression. They're seen from behind, almost as if they're dehumanised. Mm-hmm. I think against that, there can be elements of great tenderness in what he does. I think he's interested in intimacy, because there are other examples in the exhibition of women who are clothed, who are having a chat, and he's interested in you know, the peculiarities of their interaction.
What about him in his life generally, and how did he behave towards the other people around him, his contemporaries and his friends? Yes. Because he had a lot of ups and downs in his life.
Degas has a reputation of being something of a misanthrope, of being cold and hostile and aggressive to people, sometimes people in his circle. But he was somebody who you can see at the beginning of his career, he has many notebooks that he uses, and he draws in them and he makes notes, and there's evidence of quite a sort of fragile individual at that point in his career. Now, it's hard to comment on somebody like that when you have access to his personality, as it were, both through those notes he makes and through letters, but also much more to what people remember of him.
Now, was he a man of letters? Because there are letters in the exhibition which are from his friends and to his friends. I mean, was he someone who corresponded widely, do you think?
It's a very good question, particularly now, because we do have some published, as well as the manuscript letters in the exhibition, which some of which are deeply moving. There's one, for example, when he writes late in life, that it bores him to write because he can't see what he's writing. But his letters are published in small volumes, but at this moment, great Degas scholar Theodore Reff is pulling together a much more comprehensive volume of Degas' correspondence. And, you know, we hope that we'll learn a lot from that, as we have from other Professor Reff's publications.
Now, in his life, he experienced, well, privilege in his early days. He went to art school, he was involved in wars, family bankruptcies, was thrown into poverty and onto the mercy of his friends. He also then had artistic success in Paris. He became a controversial figure, and then ended up in isolation and eventual abandonment, didn't he? So he had this absolutely extraordinary path in his life.
I think he did. I mean, I think there was a sort of solid baseline of privilege. His grandfather was a banker. His father ran a branch of that bank in Paris, because the original bank is in Naples. And there still is in Naples the Palazzo Degas, So that of course, has long since passed into other hands. But as he grew up, he had access to people who collected art. So it was really when the banking business got into trouble where he did lose some money and did have to be very sort of keen in promoting his own work. But I think it's safe to say that he had a fairly comfortable existence throughout his life. His last years were very sad, yes. You know, imagine the tragedy of an artist losing his sight from his mid-30s. So this isn't an old age affliction. This is something he has to live with deteriorating for about 50 years.
There are masses, obviously, of exhibits that tell his story in this wonderful exhibition that's been received so well by everybody. What have been the highlights of it for you as a curator? I mean, obviously, you've got a figurine like The Little Dancer, which has a story to tell in itself, but is that one of them?
The Little Dancer is always intriguing, and I think we've tried to, in the exhibition, we've tried to look at her beyond the Durga icon, to look at how people reacted to her when she was displayed in the 1880s. And that, of course, is very different from how we respond to her now. And it's very, very hard to pick out favourites, if you like, in the exhibition. I could list many of them now, but that's perhaps not of many, including one extraordinary nude, which is, like many of them, called After the Bath, a pastel drawing with its counterproof companion, and it's the most extraordinary pose. If anybody is able to get out of a bath in the way Durga represents it in this drawing, I'd love to see it. It looks almost impossible. But it's as if he's, what I love about it is that it shows Durga challenging himself very late in life. He just keeps going back and experimenting.
Now, was he an obsessive? Because he worked very hard on his experimenting with new techniques in each phase of his art, and was very he was a very serious man, wasn't he, in terms of producing art?
Oh, I think he was very serious about his career as an artist. Even age 21, he writes, "I must drill down. I must avoid all the tra-la-la of the art world, so as to carve out an original corner all to myself, a niche of my own." That persists throughout his life. I think certainly he had some obsessive tendencies, but what's wonderful is to read accounts of, you know, when he does become obsessive. You know, for example, when he begins to do a lot of work as a printmaker, his friends say he's almost turned into a metal plate.
Now, I mean, looking at the bust of Degas and some of his works, they seem quite solemn in many ways, but his drawings were different, weren't they? Because he did caricatures, humorous images, he had another side to him.
Oh, I think Degas certainly had an extremely well-developed sense of humour. Now, if that was sort of slightly turned against you, he could have what he himself described as a wicked tongue. So I expect he was something of a tease, but whether or not you got his tease or whether or not you just felt you were under attack is another thing. But I think encapsulating that side of Durga, because you're quite right, he looks sort of pretty formidable in the bust and pretty serious in other portraits in the exhibition. But there's a wonderful drawing by Giovanni Baldini, his Italian friend, of Durga at a cafe table with wrinkles and crow's feet around his eyes as if he's laughing, and a lady opposite him clearly very much amused. And that's the Durga I was hoping to recreate, or at least not to lose sight of in the year of the centenary of his death.
Now, obviously, with painting of landscapes, as a founder of Impressionism, you'd expect him to be very pro landscapes, but he was dismissive of them and yet indulged in them as well at the same time.
Yes.
What was that all about?
Yes, I know, you're quite right. I mean, almost everything you say about Durga ends up having a but attached to it. So he was serious, but he was deeply funny. And landscapes, you're quite right. He was very dismissive of the Impressionist's idea to capture the fleeting moment in nature. I think that's because, one reason it might be because, is that he's very aware of the artificiality of art. So, you know, in his mind, what's the point of trying to represent in paint a gust of wind? Because it can't possibly be naturalistic, because it's artificial by definition.
But you have a great quote on the wall saying the air one sees in a painting is not the air we breathe. It sort of encapsulates that point, doesn't it, to some extent?
We've tried to sort of bring Durga to life throughout the exhibition, and there are ways, you know, ways in which you do that. So, you know, for example, in some of the works, quite a lot of the works, you can see his fingerprints. So you've got the feeling of this sort of very tactile individual.
Especially on the, I mean, on the bronzes, which I gather were originally wax sculptures that were then later bronze, because those have all been made with I don't know how he made those, in wax, first of all. Lots of wonderful bronze figurines.
Yes. Well, Durga only worked in wax. Well, wax and mixed media, like something called plastiline, and, you know, used armatures on which to model these. And there's quite a good description in the exhibition of, you know, how he actually went about making this, the materials and techniques. But the bronzes were all made after his death with the permission of his heirs. Durga himself said that he had no interest in casting anything in bronze because it was what he called a medium for eternity. And he would say his interest lay, if he'd made a wax figurine, in crushing it into a grate of wax and starting again.
Now, obviously, he died in, is it 1917, at an old age, pretty much on his own, and a number of things were found in his flat, weren't they, afterwards, that people didn't know about. But the after Degas section, which is the last part of the exhibition, what does that show us about his legacy as an artist?
Yes, well, I think it shows us that it exists. And it, of course, the objective really in that section is not to say, you know, a painter looked at this by Durga and then painted, you know, something of his or her own. The point really is encapsulated by what Francis Bacon said, that every, you know, every artist contains an echo of other artists. So it's almost like a chamber of echoes in that room.
And they basically reverberate this whole idea that you draw from other artists, you produce art, and then that reverberates and affects other artists, but even to Lucian Freud.
Yes, I think there's... I mean, it's quite interesting looking at somebody like Walter Sickert, who was the only artist of the group in the After Durga section who knew him. And, you know, at his treatment of the nude, at his treatment of perspective, and how there's a sort of filter also into British art, not just through Sickert, but he's certainly a sort of... He certainly shows the way for some other artists. But, you know, when you look at the Lucian Freud in the exhibition, for example, the woman with the egg, after you've seen the extraordinary drawing by Durga of this sort of deformed figure after the bath, then, you know, you can see there's a sort of permissiveness, there's a freedom of interpretation, of even down to the point of a certain ugliness or gawkiness or discomfort. And again, like Durga, Freud is looking at his figure from above. So you've got an uncomfortably close encounter with this nude figure.
I've been looking at a lot of the figures in some of the paintings, like David and Goliath and what have you, or in the nudes. There's a kind of rawness about them, isn't there?
Yes, I think so. And it's very interesting that you pick on David and Goliath, of course, which is one of the paintings we examined with infrared technology, to see very much more classical style nudes underneath it. And it's hard to know exactly when Durga would have painted the David and Goliath on top of that, but it's got a very, very, almost, I agree, and a sort of expressionistic quality to the vigour of the paint handling.
So how would you summarise Degas' place in art of the in the Impressionists?
I think if we're talking about it in terms of Impressionism, I think it's possibly the most important thing to say is that he didn't call himself an Impressionist. He called himself a realist and an independent. Now, I think independence is something which is visible throughout Durga's life and in his art. He likes to know no bounds. He likes to not only cultivate a sort of notion of unknowability and doing something that takes people by surprise.
Well, I hope you consider yourself properly primed for probably the best exhibition of the year in Cambridge, so don't miss it. It closes on January the 14th. Art Language Location has celebrated its 5-year anniversary in Cambridge, promoting and staging arts events across the city with a high-impact fundraiser party in London. The platform has had many successes in the field of promoting live performance in public spaces, art installations in key locations, and poetry events. After a slow year, Art Language Location is now appealing widely for funding to create a new wave of activity in the city to take it forward into 2018. Founder Robert Good dropped into Cambridge 105 to give us an update on what's been happening as they reach a milestone and looks forward to this year's plans, which open with PLACE, Relinking, Relating and Relaying, an exhibition at Cambridge School of Art on the 25th of January till February the 17th, featuring 15 artists from Italy, Slovenia and Bosnia. Robert, tell me about what's your current role in Art Language Location, which is obviously a great scheme that started some years ago.
I started it about 5 years ago to bring more art to Cambridge, contemporary art, experimental art, and bring some more artists to Cambridge. And we've been going strong ever since. And so my role is organiser. I'm chair of the group and we've got a committee and put on various projects around Cambridge and elsewhere.
Art Language Location obviously has had a lot of success in making Cambridge an art destination, which was obviously the mission that you were taking on in the first place. Has that mission changed or developed over the last few years, basically?
I think it has. I think, well, we've always wanted to put art in locations around Cambridge, and so we've put them in pubs, and we put them in colleges, we put them in shops, all sorts of different places, out and about, and that's still the same. I think the focus changes a little bit. It turned into this large festival that we had once a year, and that was really great, but it was becoming too big for us to really maintain. So what we've really wanted to do is to go back to our roots and go back to bringing art to Cambridge in different individual projects rather than as one great big hit at one time during the year.
And some of those projects have been absolutely great. Some of the things you've done on the Sidgwick side with poets and things like that, where people have been, we had, I think it was Alexandra Drysdale, in a car, was basically filled with poetry that had been written on the interior of the car. And what you did was you went in and you sat down inside the car and you read the poetry or had a poem read to you. That kind of thing is still going on. I noticed just recently that at Addenbrooke's Hospital they had the Emergency Poet, which was another poet inside a converted 1960s ambulance. So
fantastic.
That if you were feeling a little bit down about what was happening at the hospital or what have you, you could go in for an emergency dose of poetry. Now, are those kind of things still going on at the moment?
Definitely. Those are the things that we want to encourage more of, because encounters like that with art is really exciting for us. We've got an event coming up tomorrow, in fact, in London, which is going to be a party to celebrate 5 years and to bring everybody together who's been working on different aspects of the project. And we've got performance poetry, we've got performance artists, we've got some artworks and pop-up interventions and so on. And we're going to continue doing more of that around Cambridge and beyond.
Does Art Language Location ever operate outside Cambridge, or is it very much a Cambridge thing? I mean, you're having the party in London, so I just wondered whether you operate in London as well.
Well, funnily enough, we're open to suggestions, and I think we're looking ahead. I would like to explore that a little bit more. We've got some artists coming over in January from Italy and Bosnia Herzegovina and Slovenia. So we're making connections with artists that we're meeting from other locations, and that's really interesting to us.
That was the whole idea, wasn't it? Very much to do that, to get that interchange of people visiting the city,
exactly.
And then hosting them with the kind of art that's going on in and around Cambridge.
I think so. To make it for us as artists interesting, and to make connections for us. But also, I think one of the roles of art is to create connections and to operate in that way in the community.
Now, obviously, we had a lot of occasions which were great in Cambridge where people had done things that they'd never done before in public spaces. And one of them was when at Anglia Ruskin University they created a whole series of about 30 boxes which emitted music, and people walked across the whole of Cambridge with different kind of peculiar music playing out all over the place, and those kind of things never happened before in Cambridge, and there was a lot of enthusiasm for that. Mm-hmm. But it's been quite a quiet year, hasn't it, in terms of people being a bit as daring as they were being at that point in time. What's happened?
Well, I think people are feeling a bit gloomy with the state of various things in the wider world. I mean, we took a bit of a breather this year as well, because we've been doing it for a while, and it takes a lot to organise. There's quite a lot of herding of cats and kind of getting everything lined up. So we took a little bit of a breather, but we've got the exhibition in January coming up. We've got ideas for some new pop-up little micro galleries and spaces around Cambridge. So watch that space for the new year. And we're looking ahead to doing some more projects and working with people in different ways. So I think it's been a quiet year, I think, for a lot of people, but I think it's on an uptick.
Now this party that's happening over the weekend is a sort of milestone milestone, isn't it, really, in terms of the whole project? It's a point where everybody takes stock of what's happened, that they celebrate together, and that they meet everybody involved in it. Looking back, the project started in 2012. And we've had a lot of things that have happened over the year. Can you tell me some of the highlights, the high points?
Some of the highlights. We've had loads. I mean, we've worked with well over 140-150 artists over the time. Particularly, like in the original one, there was "You Are Here" as a big neon sign that lit up Parker's piece, and we had some text that was on the Trumpington Park and Ride bus station that's still there. And we've had some performances. A lot of people liked. We had some yellow silicone shaggy dogs that were being marched around Parker's piece for a few days. And one of the highlights, or one of the most unusual locations, I think we found, was the Cambridge nuclear bunker, where one of the artists managed to get his work inside the nuclear bunker, which was rather fine. So all sorts of different things, really.
Now, this whole idea of having spaces which you can utilise for art obviously has been really important. Obviously, changing spaces did a lot with that. Mm-hmm. But changing spaces is at the moment also on the back burner to some mm-hmm. degree. Has there been a kind of a little bit of a retreat from being active amongst organisations like yours, do you think?
I think in some ways, possibly. But I think actually there's a sense also that there's more art in Cambridge, certainly than I think when we started 5 years ago. So, I mean, these things kind of go in cycles. I mean, Gallery 9 is now taking over the Norfolk Street space, and that's doing some really exciting things. So I think,
I mean, Gallery 9, 9 has this link, doesn't it, with Anglia Ruskin University uh-huh. and Cambridge School of Art, and they now are going to be quite an incubator for those artists, because there's going to be a whole chain of them who are going to be exhibiting in Gallery 9, and that's going to be a place which is a very small art space, and obviously changing spaces used it a lot, mm-hmm. but it's now going to be quite a key art space, because they plan to show you all the up-and-coming stuff that's going to be coming through there. Now, obviously, looking forward, that you've got an exhibition coming up in January, which uh-huh. is going to be obviously starting off in Cambridge School of Art. It's called Place, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And can you tell me about those three artists and what they're going to be doing?
So there are going to be more like 15 artists. They're from three different countries, and they're going to be bringing different artworks to Cambridge around the ideas of community and collaboration and conversation. And there are all sorts of different works. We've got some neon works. We've got some nice interactive ones. We've got one artist who wants to ask the question, where and when were you happiest? And inviting people to put their answers on a postcard to us and send them in. So that'll be interesting to see that one. And we've got some sound pieces, and we've got some video work. And it's been really interesting, because just organising it with people from different countries, the location, the distances and the language barriers and so on, they provide a whole new set of problems, but also make you realise how interconnected we all are.
That injects something fresh into the local art scene, because they're from Bosnia, Italy and Slovenia, aren't they? And obviously seeing what other artists are doing in places like that must be really interesting for your artists, the ones who are local.
I think that's really important, that they're coming from very different starting points. They're the issues that they're dealing with, the social arenas in which they are, they're very different to us. Cambridge can sometimes feel like a little bit like a bubble, so it's really refreshing to have these other points of view.
Now, obviously, funding is a big issue with this party that you're having, that you want to attract funding for the kind of projects that Art Language Location puts on. And these are exciting art projects. They're art projects that happen in public spaces, in areas that aren't being utilised. They're projects which involve people in a very fun and pleasurable way, and they're usually quite unusual as well. So do you think you're going to have a problem now getting together enough funding to take the project forward?
It's always difficult, and Arts Council funding, which has been very generous in the past, is very constrained these days. So we're definitely looking at all opportunities. And yes, definitely, if anybody would like to kind of come and work with us and sponsor us, I think what we found with the locations and the people that we've worked with is that they get a bit of a buzz from doing projects like these, because they're so different to what they're normally doing, that it gives them something a little bit different, and it provides some nice publicity, some footfall and some interest around those locations. So absolutely, we're going to be looking to make new contacts. We've already had a nice bit of sponsorship from the Cambridge BID Consortium, which is fantastic, and we'd like to thank them. So definitely up for that in future, looking at creative ways of you know, keeping the show on the road.
Now, if the money became available, if somebody was kind enough to say that actually we're going to put some money into the arts, we're going to do something with you, and obviously partnerships with business can be a good thing like that, like at the mm-hmm. Illuminate Festival, you know, where you find a kind of synergy with the art project and the business sponsor. But if money became available, what would you do in 2018 if you got the best case scenario?
Well, we'd like to set up a a couple of new locations around town where people can come and expect to see some artwork and have a rolling programme where we can introduce new artists who can maybe show some work for a month, maybe in a shop window, maybe in an open space, a place where we can showcase some new artists and bring some more artists to Cambridge.
Robert Good, thank you very much indeed for coming in to talk to me.
Thank you very much.
If you're Chinese and recently arrived in Cambridge, you may be looking for some kind of cultural interface to identify with to get you started, and your hosts often have a problem knowing where to take you first and what to show you in the Cambridge bubble. I've been talking to Cambridge poet, journalist, teacher and Chinese translator John Drew, who's often charged with showing Chinese academics and students around and also dabbles in Chinese poetry. He's found, as so many people have, that after you've shown them the colleges and some oriental gardens and restaurants to prevent them from becoming homesick, tongue-tied or culture-shocked, the poetry of Zhu Shimo always hits the spot culturally, putting them at their ease. Plaques to the poet exist in several colleges and the most prominent on King's Backs in Marble, which are treated like holy shrines by visiting tourists. But there's a sticking point, which is that you get charged a whacking £8.50 to view or take a photograph of it. Ain't that a bit outrageous? Zhu Shimo's life in Cambridge is so famous in China that its people still explore the city to see the world he inhabited and wrote about during the era of the Bloomsbury set and Virginia Woolf, since he was a student at the same time in the 1920s. John introduced me to the poem On Leaving Cambridge, which he sounds out in Chinese first for flavour, and told me much I didn't know about a remarkable man who crossed the gulf between English and Chinese poetic romanticism.
Qing qing de wo zola. Zheng ru wo qing qing de lai, wo qing qing de zhao shou, zhu bei shi tian de yun chai. My Chinese is getting a little rusty now. I could have plenty of chances to use it in the middle of Cambridge these days, but I haven't been doing so.
It's actually great to hear some of the beginning of Zhu Shimo's poem on leaving Cambridge, which you just said. Now, I've just discovered recently, having spent some time with Chinese people in Cambridge, and you talk about many things in Cambridge, you know, they get out and about and all the rest of it, but eventually people always discover Zhu Shimo. Why do you think that is?
Well, in China, of course, Zhu Shimo was a writer in the 1920s, and during the early days of the Mao regime, then he was out of favour. He was the wrong sort of romantic poet. But he was a very well-known international figure in his own time, and indeed when the Indian Nobel Prize winner Rabindranath Tagore went to China, Zhu Shimo was his host. Zhu Shimo came here and he was a student of Goldsworthy Lois Dickinson, who was of course a great friend of E.M. Forster's in King's. They were very close together. They travelled to India together. Forster stayed in India. Goldsworthy Lois Dickinson went on to China. So there was quite a little network of people in India and China and England who knew one another. They all had literary interests.
He was a man who made waves because he was a very free-thinking poet, wasn't he?
Yes.
And he was seeking to loosen Chinese poetry from its traditions.
Yes.
And introduce Western romanticism into it.
Yes, I mean, this is after the revolution in China in 1911. Then this was true in all forms of Lu Xun, of course, in the short stories and so forth. Satirical short stories, and it was Zhu Shimo. It was again, yes, there was huge. The most popular play, of course, in China at this time was Ibsen's The Doll's House. And it was very, very popular. There was a huge influence from the West in China at this time. Yes.
When you encounter Chinese people in Cambridge, you have, you mentioned to me earlier that you always have this problem, which is what to show them and how to show them around Cambridge and which things that they can discover. And obviously Zhu Shimo is one of them. But what are the other things that you've experienced when you've dealt with Chinese people in Cambridge?
Well, I must confess that, I mean, when I first came to Cambridge in the 1970s, the only person who was really, well, many people perhaps, but the most prominent Chinese scholar here was Joe Needham, who was then Master of Keys. He was in some opprobrium because, of course, like the Red Dean of Canterbury, he was not only a sincere Anglican, but he was also very much in favour of the communist regime. Keyes these days doesn't figure very prominently in Chinese. Of course, in those days, you hardly saw a Chinese person in town. There was Charlie Chan's. There was Jin Ying, of course, who's now a prominent professor in the architecture department, but that was about all. Now people come here, and if they want to spend their money in Cambridge for £8.50, they can go and see this stone that was recently put up about Zhu Zhimo's poem. I myself feel quite clearly that the poem wasn't written anywhere near King's anyway. It was written out... A poet conceives in his own mind, but it's so obviously Grantchester Meadows, and he used to go out there with Goldsworthy, Lois Dickinson, and the Bloomsbury set, Forster, and of course Virginia Woolf, those people all went off to the orchard in Grantchester. And his poem, which deals with willow trees and the sun in the west and so forth, it's all very much Grantchester Meadows. But now, of course, we've got all these, as the Chinese tourists have come into town, you've got all these statues, you've got one in Clare, you've got two in John's. But I don't take them. Well, of course, if they want to see those places, of course, they're very beautiful for their English heritage. But the places that I take them to, first of all, are the Needham Institute out in Herschel Road, because the Needham Institute has this lovely little garden which marries a Suzhou garden, these little miniature lakes and mountains that you have in Suzhou in China. It marries that with Binbrook and the English countryside very nicely, a nice mix of bamboos and elms. And the other place I take them, another similar garden, is the garden at Wolfson College, where you've got a South Seas Chinese Assembly Hall, a 1930s English house, and the Assembly Hall picks up the same line of the roof. And you've got a garden, which again is a lovely mixture of Chinese and English, called an Anglo-Chinese garden.
Now, from studying his work, what have you actually discovered in Zhu Zhimo's work that has basically struck a chord with you, and what's made it special for you?
Well, I must confess, I'm not a Chinese scholar, and for me it was special to be trying to write. Since I was asking my Chinese students to write English poetry, I would, and many of them were terrified by the prospect. His workshop just says, well, write and try it, see how it goes, and every week read them out and see how they go. I set out by writing Chinese poems myself on the board, and the students roared with laughter. And it was a deliberate ploy, of course, because I didn't want them to feel inadequate when they started writing English poetry, when they saw that their teacher was absolutely appalling when he tried to write Chinese poetry. But the appeal to Zhu Zhimo was, of course, because I came from Cambridge. They said, we all have to study this poem. That's why we were fascinated. And so the first poem I tried to translate was this one. But then I went off into other poets, a little bit of Du Fu and a little bit of Wang Wei and Li Bai and some of the famous poets. But I've only dabbled. Very dilettante, I'm afraid.
Okay, so if you're struck by a little bit of romanticism, we're now going to hear a bit of... We're going to hear from John, Making Leave of Cambridge Again by Zhu Zhimo.
Farewell to Grantchester Meadows. Unnoticed, I am going away, just as nobody saw me come. I clasp my hands and bow my head as clouds puff up in the west. One willow radiant in the sun, stands like a bride on the river bank. The image fades with the evening light to be kindled again in my heart. Water weeds on the river bed flicker below me and beckon me down. I'd gladly become one strand of that weed in the lazy flow of the Cam. There's a pool in the shade of an elm churning. Bits of a shattered rainbow bobbing about on its surface settle into the colour of my dream. My dream floats onward into the night, slow as a punt being poled upstream. The green grass here grows ever greener. The stars set everything free to sing. Sadly, I have no heart to sing. My flute has become a broken reed. The crickets know, they too fall silent. Can silence compose its own song? Without a sound, I am going away, just as I came without a word. I wrap myself in the sleeves of my gown and leave it all there to the last wisp of cloud. Now that's almost a literal translation. Well, I say it's after Zhu Zhimo. My Chinese students were horrified by the translation of the line, can silence compose its own song? I was just working from a Chinese dictionary. And part of the trouble you have, many of the characters look very alike. And I got the wrong character. And so actually that line should read, I can't remember now something about, but something about the streets of Cambridge tonight. And I got, I think the streets of Cambridge tonight fall silent. But I had this line from my mistranslation in the dictionary, can silence compose its own song? And I so like the line in English. But I kept the line because it works. It works well in probably the best line of the poem in English. But it means that it's no longer jugement. To write, when you're writing a poem in your own language, you are using metaphor. You're translating out. Poets will spend hours tearing up, throwing away. You must have the freedom to destroy anything. One of the advantages of translation is you have a good poem in front of you in another language. One of the disadvantages is you must stick to that. You can't tear up and throw away, except in the one line that I've done. And so I often find when I'm translating that I want the freedom to create a poem in the new, in my own language, in English. And that often means taking me some way away from the original.
So Jugement had this rather extraordinary life. I mean, tell me a little bit more about his friendship with J. Lewis Dickinson, because this was somebody who he spent time with in Cambridge.
Yes.
And who also, as far as I gather, indulged in impersonating a Chinese person later on in his career.
Yeah, Gogoli is quite extraordinary because, he was very taken. He was as taken by China as Forster was by India. He went on to China, they went on a scholarship. And Goldie actually later wrote a book called Letters of John Chinaman. Now, in the 18th century, during the Enlightenment, China was seen as the ideal society. And Oliver Goldsmith wrote letters, as if he was a Chinaman, criticizing European society in terms of Chinese, what was understood of Chinese society. And he laughed at the way that people picked up Chinese knickknacks here and use them for all the wrong purposes and out of context. Goldsworthy Lewis Dickinson did the same thing. He wrote a book, I think it was published in 1901, Letters of John Chinaman, in which he criticised the West in terms of traditional Chinese culture. And he had a very, very strong feeling for China. And so when Jugement was here, very naturally, they got along very well.
John Drew, thank you very much
indeed for discussing Jugement.
Cambridge's Gallery 9 in Norfolk Street looks set to become an artist's incubator venue, with its recently renewed links to Cambridge School of Art and a resident group of working artists who are only too glad to have found a new place to work with studios above and exhibit their work. The former Changing Spaces Gallery is now being run by American expressionist artist Paul Arsenault and is to be opened up and joined to the CB2 Cafe this year with a walkthrough from the restaurant floor, which will enhance the CB2 experience as both a music venue and arts hub. Paul's a practicing artist using oils and is currently painting allegorical self-portraits. He aligns with US talking movements and New York's new casualists. He gave me some time out to talk about his work and where the gallery is now going.
Paul, first of all, tell me a little bit about your bio. Where do you come from and how do you come to be here?
Sure, I'm actually American, an expat from the States. I've been in Cambridge about 3 years, came over for work. My wife got a job at AstraZeneca and I kind of came with her. I do a lot of web development, so contracting, and then my painting I can do anywhere. So I thought finding space in Cambridge was a unique challenge that I wasn't expecting. But now that that's worked out, I'm back to painting and trying to be an artist, I guess.
Did you go to art school in America?
I did. I went to Massachusetts College of Art and Design, which is the only public or government art school in the country. Yeah, I went in wanting to do some foundry work, some sculpture, but when I started painting, I just kind of felt like there's so much I needed to learn about it that I just focused solely on painting and just did that for 4 straight years, basically.
Okay, so what happens when you paint? Do you find it sort of, what kind of an experience do you have when you paint normally?
It's a bit of a fight, I think. It's, or not so much a dance, more like a boxing match, I'd say. You know, it's for me, my method is a little more immediate, I think, than planned out. So I'm doing a lot of putting paint on and scraping paint off, and it always seems like a battle with the canvas and the painting. Sometimes I win it and sometimes the canvas wins it, and if the canvas wins, it gets painted over or cut up or something. But
do you have kind of different energy levels when you're doing it? Do you find it frustrating at times or?
Yeah, I mean, energy, when I'm there to paint, I'm pretty engaged in it. There was a time where I blew out my knee, and so because I paint standing up and I kind of like moving around the space, I went to more subtle kind of minimalist works that I could sit in front of. So yeah, I think a certain amount of energy and and just being able to move around the space is important to my work.
Now, who are your influences? I see that we've got a very large canvas in front of us here, which is of, well, it's a kind of, it's like a like a cityscape almost, but also it's with a kind of phantasmagorical dog in front. Tell me a bit about that painting.
Since I've been in Cambridge, I've been thinking about the States again, and people keep asking, are you going to stay in Cambridge or are you going to move? And I really don't have an answer to it. So this is sort of an idea of where I would want to go. You can see I take different pieces of the location I'm thinking of and the location I'm at. I mean, you can see the zebra crossing that the wolf is sitting on, and the skyline, the hazed out skyline is Brooklyn. So it's kind of a combination of maybe where I want to be and where I currently am.
So it expresses your dreams and aspirations and things that are going on in your life, and basically those come together in an image which combines lots of different things.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Okay. I mean, how do you describe your art to other people? What would you say you're trying to do with it, basically?
I realized just this year that I've been painting self-portraits for 15 years. So even though it's not a direct representation, I'm sort of aiming it towards allegorical self-portraits. You know, there's a story behind it. There's an allegory behind it. Sometimes I appear in it, you know, but I'm always present in kind of the concept of it. I like thick, heavy paint, and they're a little brash, I think, colorful.
So should you draw on your own experiences of where your life is going? Is that what you're trying to express, your journey through life?
Yeah, since I've been in Cambridge, I think I've really ramped it up. I did my master's here at Cambridge School of Art, and that kind of got me focused very internally, you know, just on the process. And since getting out of there, I have been sort of trying to explore what it means to be dislocated, you know, taken away, not taken away, but moved from a very comfortable place in the United States, very comfortable life, to, even though it's the same language, it's a completely different culture, and just kind of where I fit in with that, and if I do even, and things like that.
Now, being immersed in Cambridge School of Art, I mean, do you draw on some of the other artists there? Do they contribute ideas to
Oh, sure. Things? Yeah, I think we all kind of bounce ideas off. My studio mate, I think, where if we look at our works, it seems like we're slowly influencing each other. You know, she's really good at being cruel to the canvas. If she doesn't like something, she'll just paint it out. And I've always had trouble with that, but I find myself doing that a little bit more now. I'm like, well, if Ellie can do it, I'm sure, like, I'll just wipe it out and see what happens. You know, I did it once, I can do it again. So
now we've got another image over here, which is it's a wonderfully dark and somber sort of abstract painting. What does that represent? Is that a mood thing, or what is it?
It is. It's since I started school, I've developed a case on and off of insomnia. In school, I used to wake up thinking about, you know, my dissertation or my, you know, my feedback or what I need to paint or my project. And when it ended, I still wake up in the middle of the night, except I don't have that in my head. So this is sort of a kind of a slower painting for me.
Is that you lying underneath a duvet in a darkened room?
Right, yeah. So that's the I was trying to get the weight of just the nighttime when you can't sleep and, you know, your eyes aren't even tired. You're awake. And yeah, just trying to capture that kind of heaviness that just kind of settles on you. In the
That's quite a large canvas. How long did it take you to create that?
Well, that's I always give the Picasso answer, my whole life plus however long it took to paint it. That was pretty fast. It's, you know, there's not a lot of color variations in it, and I did a lot of pre-sketching for it, and just kind of had the idea pretty solidified in my head. That one came together pretty quickly, you know, a couple of sittings, like three or four sittings probably.
And what kind of paints are you using?
Oil. It's almost exclusively oil paint. I'll throw other things in there based on how I feel. Oil. I leave some of the drawing in there, so sometimes you can see some charcoal or pencil kind of gets into. You can see this is the on the skyline of the Brooklyn painting that I've kind of left the charcoal grid in there. And I'm just kind of playing with that, with the different kind of mediums. So this was one of my pieces for my final project at uni, at Cambridge School of Art. And I did it, I wanted to explore the American gun culture. And so, you know, I wrote out my proposal, and I was going to try to take an unbiased approach, just, you know, and explore the culture of guns and why, you know, why Americans love guns so much. And then the day I passed in my presentation, my initial presentation, I woke up the next morning to the Pulse nightclub shooting. And so that sort of changed the whole thing. I didn't really want to take a, you know, like a highbrow view of guns. And, you know, I wanted just to go at some of these talking points that come out. And this is based loosely on the Aurora theater shooting in Denver. And, you know, all the politicians come out and the NRA comes out and they say, well, you know, if we all had guns, we would have stopped this guy. And I took a slightly different take on it, that if we all had guns, it would be mayhem with, you know, I think there would have been a lot more carnage in those situations.
Is there a Quentin Tarantino in that as well, though? That sort of Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah, like the over the top. And the movie they're watching is actually Scarface. It's the scene from Scarface, the Say Hello to My Little Friend, one of the most violent scenes. So I'm playing a little bit with, you know, questioning whether or not American film has anything to do with some of the issues. You know, so I just didn't want to say, I hate guns, I think this would happen, but I just wanted to make it a little bit ambiguous to what I was saying and let the viewer maybe decide on their own. This one's not quite as subtle as some of my other ones.
You're working here at Gallery 9 and you're basically wearing two hats, aren't you? You're working upstairs in your studio and then you're also running this gallery. What's it like being in that position?
Yeah, as an artist, I should have known better to try to start up a gallery. But no, it's been fun. It's, you know, it just sort of happened bit by bit. You know, it's a little bit of a distraction because there's always someone in the gallery. You know, it's easy to come up with an excuse not to paint because you're in here and, you know, some of the other artists are in here that are invigilating. And, you know, before you know it, you're chatting with them and, you know, I haven't made it upstairs. But, you know, we're kind of working that out. It's been good. It's nice to have a space in Cambridge again. Because they really, I don't feel like there's a space like this, you know, since Changing Spaces left that can actually offer, you know, kind of a contemporary art scene, which is what we're trying to do here.
So what is the mission for the space
here? We want to be Cambridge's contemporary art gallery. It's a very simple, short mission statement. And, you know, that hopefully, you know, lets us interact with some of the other organizations. You know, we'll see what happens when Kettle Yard opens back up. Kettle's Yard opens back up. You know, we've met some people from Wysing that have gone through their program. We really have a good relationship at Cambridge School of Art, who used to utilize the space. And their master's program just had a show here last week for one of their modules. So I have to thank CB2 for letting us use the space. They've been great. It's, you know, it's really hard to find space in Cambridge. And to be able to get the studio space is fantastic, you know, because it's kind of changed everybody's lives up there. Just since March, we've had it. So, you know, it's great to have working artists up there. And then to have this space, hopefully we can continue. You know, they want to combine that space and kind of bring the cafe into this area. But hopefully we can keep the gallery feel when they do that. We'll see.
Okay, so lots coming up in Gallery 9 in 2018, obviously kicking off in January with the Place exhibition and lots of incubator artists to come and see, so it's a great little hub for people to visit. Paul, thank you very much indeed for sparing me some of your
time. Oh, sure, thanks for having me on.
This month, there are a few events not to miss if you have the time and the inclination. Trinity College Music Society presents Nacht Music at Trinity College Chapel on January the 26th. The Haunted History of Huntington's Authors is featured at the Cambridge Central Library on the 28th, and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra plays Haydn, Bruch and Bartok at the Corn Exchange on January the 18th. Well, that's all we have time for this month's Arts Roundup. I'll be back with lots of news stories in February, and I hope you'll join me in the Art Dimension then.